So, based on your response, I'm not going to do a plot summary since it seems like you've all seen the movie. So I'm just going to jump in and just read a short chapter and then talk to Stephen and answer any question you may have. Maybe not any, but... all right. I'm going to read the chapter where Matt King takes his daughter, Alexandra, and Sid, the tag-along boyfriend, to meet with his father-in-law and you tell him about the news that he's going to take, that he has to take his daughter, you know, off of life support. Sorry if you can't see me. We sit on the wraparound deck because that's where Scott was when we drove up, sitting in a wicker chair with a drink balancing on his knees. I can see Scotty in the lower yard with her grandmother, pointing to the various things they see. Rock, I imagine her saying, pond. Joni's mother has Alzheimer's, and Scott has been carrying on with his altered wife and her nurse, doing yard work, swimming laps in the pool. I've seen him swimming before, and when he comes up for air, the sight of him in his goggles and swimmer's cap is heartbreaking. His face slick with water, his mouth drawn out like the creature in the stream. Drinking is another one of his hobbies. It runs in the family. I could smell the scotch on his breath when he saw Scotty and said, "Bingo," something he always says when he sees her. I've told him the news and given him her living will, which he's now looking over. Sid has been quiet, for which I'm grateful, but then I really look at him on the lounge chair, his black sunglasses on, his black cap pulled down, his stillness, and I realize he's asleep. Alex sits on the end of the lounger by his legs. It's irritating seeing her so close to him all the time. "This is like some other language," Scott says, flipping through the pages. "What is this?" "It's a living will. You have one, too." "Yes, but it's not a bunch of jibber-jabber. This is like reading Korean." He shakes the pages at Alex and me. "I'm sure yours is the same." "Jibber-jabber," he mumbles. "I'll explain it to you. I know it's a difficult language. Do you want me to go over it?" "It's an advanced directive, basically her instructions, telling us what medical procedure she wants, or in this case, doesn't want. No mechanical ventilation, no." "I don't want to hear it. I know exactly what it says. It says that she doesn't want everyone waiting around while she spoils like milk." "Gramps," Alex says, "are you okay?" I prepared myself for this, and I'm glad Joni had the good sense to write this thing here and wasn't a selfish person. "She's a brave girl," he yells, his voice shaking. "She was always stronger than her brother." Barry whines his way through life. He looked 30 when he was 16. He may even be a homosexual for all I know. "She's stronger than you, Matt," Scott says. "She lived more than a year, in a year than you did in a decade, sitting in your office, hoarding your cash. Maybe if you let her have her own boat and bought her some safe equipment or let her go on one of those shopping sprees that women like, then maybe she wouldn't have engaged in these reckless sports. Maybe if you provided more thrills at home." "Gramps," Alex says. "And you, Alexandra, you fought with your mother when all she was trying to do was instill some drive in you. Joni had passion." "She's a good girl," he says, as though arguing with someone. "I never told her all this, but I'm saying it now." He stands up and walks to the porch rail so his back is to us. His shoulders shudder. He looks up with his hands on his hips, as though gauging the weather to come. He lifts his flannel shirt to wipe his face and coughs, spits, then faces us. "You guys want some rolls? I made rolls. You want a drink?" His eyes are glassy and his hands drum in his pockets. "I like the way men cry. They're efficient." "Sure, Scott. We'd love some rolls and a drink." When he goes into the house, I look at Alex. "You okay?" "He's just upset." "I know, it's fine." She doesn't look fine. "So what happens when you do that?" she asks. "Do what?" remove everything. I mean, how long does it take? I talked to the doctor this morning, listened as he told me that Joni could breathe quite well on her own and could live up to a week without help. I tell her, about a week, I guess. When do they do this? They're waiting for us to come in, I say. Oh. She touches Sid's leg, but he doesn't move. Scotty and her grandmother walk toward us with stalks of white ginger in their hands. Scotty holds her grandmother's hand and leads her up the stairs. I never know what to say to Alice. Our encounters are similar to when someone shows me an infant, and I feel like I'm the one on display, everyone watching to see how I interact with it. Hi, Grandma, Alex and I sing. She looks at both of us. Scott comes out with his rolls and a tray of drinks, scotch on the rocks. I don't even bother to take the drink meant for Alex. I know she won't drink in front of me. Sid suddenly sits up and looks around like a dog that smells bacon. He reaches for a drink and I stare at his hand around the glass. He lets go and leans back in the chair. Scott glares at him and Sid salutes. Who are you? Scott asks. Why are you here? He's my friend, Alex says. He's here for me. Scott still stares at Sid, then turns to Alice and hands her the scotch. We're going to go see Joni today, he says. Alice grins. And Chachi? She asks. Sid bursts out laughing, and Scott turns back to him, then places a hand on his shoulder, which makes me fear for his life. You be quiet, son, Scott says. I could kill you with this hand. This hand has been places. Scott lifts his hand off Sid's shoulder and turns again to his wife. No, Alice, our Joni, our daughter. We're going to give her anything she wants. He glares at me. Think about what she should want, what she would want, Alice. We're going to get it for her and bring it to her, bring it right to her bed. Joni and Chachi, Alice chants. Joni and Chachi. Shut up, Alice, Scott yells. Alice looks at Scott as though he just said cheese. She clasps her hands together and smiles, staying in the pose for a few seconds. He looks at her face and squints. Sorry, old gal, he says. You go ahead and say whatever you want. It was funny, Sid says. All I was doing was laughing. She has a good sense of humor. Maybe she knows she's being funny. I think she does. I'm going to hit you, Scott says. His arms hang alongside him, the muscles flexed, veins big like milkshake straws. I know he's going to hit Sid, because that's what he does. I've seen him hit Barry. I, too, have been hit by Scott after I beat him and his buddies at a game of poker. His hands are in fists, and I can see his knobby old man knuckles, the many liver spots almost joining to become one big discoloration like a burn. Then he pops his fist up towards Sid, a movement like a snake rearing its head and lunging forth. I see Sid start to bring his arm up to block his face, but then he brings it down and clutches his thigh. It's almost as if he decided not to protect himself. The end result is a punch in his right eye, a screaming older daughter, a frightened younger daughter, a father trying to calm many people at once, and a mother-in-law cheering wildly as though we have all done something truly amazing. And I'll stop there.
Well, so now we move into the interview section of tonight's program. We're supposed to be thinking of the actor's studio, kind of behind the scenes, sort of a behind the page kind of
just like that,
you know, situation, as if you were all just here in our living room for an informal discussion. We've even brought my chairs. So,
and the wine.
We have the wine, we have our wine, we have the chairs, we're all set up here. Well, first of all, I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you all for coming. And I want to welcome you back to Colorado College.
I know.
One of the things that I found out as we were walking across the campus from Armstrong was that this is the first time that you've been back to campus.
And walking down that path was just, like, the last time I walked down this path, I was not wearing a dress and shoes like these. I think I was skateboarding, but Yeah, it was neat.
So if you would take someone on, you know, Carrie Hart Hemming's, tour of CC, mm-hmm. what would it include?
Well, I lived at Slocum Dorm.
Right.
That's a very hard question because I don't remember the names of the buildings, but I remember eating here. This is the dining hall, right? And they'd have kind of vegetarian food, right? Huh. Yeah. But no, I'm not going to take you on a tour of my past life here, but I will tell you that I have fond memories of Critical Practices with John Simons and my poetry workshop with Jane Hilberry, and they're both here tonight, and that's really special to me.
Well, thanks for coming back.
And yeah.
What we're going to do tonight is we're going to talk a little bit about the Descendants, and we're going to watch some clips. But before we do that, can you tell us a little bit about the Descendants, the process of writing the novel? Mm-hmm. It started off as a short story in your first collection. Can you talk a little bit about that process? How long it took you to write, and maybe the moment when you thought that first story is.
Well, it started out as a short story called The Minor Wars, which is in House of Thieves, which is my first collection of stories. And I wrote, when I was a Stegner Fellow, I started another novel. And it just never came to be. And this was after publishing the story collection.
Right.
And then I had a baby, a little girl, and so I think the Descendants came out of pure desperation and fear. I thought I would never write again, never be able to publish anything again. And as soon as she hit the sack and took her naps, I wrote desperately. And first of all, I had to choose what I was going to write about. And I went back to the Meyer Wars, and I went back to this Matt King character, and I just saw these possibilities for expansion. And once I decided upon his voice, because I didn't know it was going to be his story mm-hmm. at first, I sort of just slipped into this role like an actor who's at the actor's studio. And I really did slip into a sort of acting role with him. And it came out very quickly. And I hate telling this to writing students that it took less than a year to write. Because it will never happen again. And I've proven that with my next novel that's taken me forever. But this one just came, I think it was a linear sort of plot, and again, just desperation and surrounded by other people way more successful than me.
Well, I want to ask you a little bit about the the process of having this, of getting it adapted into a movie, and how you feel about the movie, and as you said, it's very interesting, like to read the novel after you've seen the movie, and mm-hmm. you really do. I think you put your finger on it. It really does deepen your experience of the movie in a lot of ways. You feel like you have some kind of backstory. But as a way into it, I thought we might watch a clip, which is in fact the clip of that moment that you read. And
okay.
So as a kind of way of talking about that, page to screen divide and disconnect and connect. I thought we would watch this clip. So I'm just going to, this is the most challenging part of the evening for me, is I'm going to try not to mess this up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this is technology here.
Hi, Alice. It's me. It's Matt. It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
It's you, too.
That's Alexandra. It's your granddaughter. This is your son-in-law, Matt. This is your family. Well, except for that kid over there, I don't know who the hell he is. So who are you? What are you doing here?
He's my friend.
Good afternoon.
Alice, we're going to Queens Hospital this afternoon and see Elizabeth.
We are?
Yes. She needs us. Just like when she was a little girl. We need to see her in the hospital. So think about what she might want to have in her room, and we'll take it to her and put it next to her bed.
Queen Elizabeth? That's wonderful. I have to put on a nice dress.
Is she serious?
Shut up, kid.
I've never met a queen before.
I'm sorry, man. I was just laughing. It's funny. I mean, I think she knows she's being funny.
I'm gonna hit you.
It's a terrific scene. And can you talk a little bit about the... It's one where, I mean, I think the most apparent difference between the film and the novel is the joke that it, or the sort of that moment of incomprehension that it centers around. Here, it's a Queen Elizabeth thing. Mm. And in the novel, it's Joni, and it's Joni and Chachi. Mm. And they're not exactly interchangeable, not to my mind. But can you talk a little bit about that in that scene, but in the film more general?
It's funny because I loved Alexander's changes. I wasn't so stuck to the book where I needed it to be so precise. And he said, I don't know if she would watch that show. And I said, yeah, maybe not. And he's like, I kind of like the joke Queen, on Queen Elizabeth. So I'm going to change her name to Elizabeth. I said, great, do it. And he did. And, we had that kind of talk about every single change in the novel. And I almost to a point where I sort of said to him, Alexander, you don't need to talk to me about everything. Come on. But I thought in the end, the scene from the book, I'm glad I read that scene too, just so you can see the comparison. But they had the same effect. And yet, the novel goes into way more detail, and yet the film brings something different to it too. And I love the music, just that when he's bringing her in, and there's just all these little things that I love about the film, and that I think, I mean, I sound funny, but that I also liked in the novel. But I feel like they complement one another, and that you can have a unique experience reading the book and watching the film without it seeming repetitive. But it's more sort of pleasantly resonant, I think.
Yeah, I think that that's right. I mean, I think that they really do strike one as being very autonomous, very separate in a lot of ways. I mean, there's obviously, as you say, the novel does, the film does follow the novel, in a lot of ways. But then you really do have the, that he's really, remade it in a very wholesale and, had a real vision about it. But and it's interesting in what I've read about you and your involvement with the film is that you're there a lot. Mm-hmm. Is that you're involved in the different stages of it in terms of providing background can you talk a little bit about that side of it, like advising on the film?
Or? Yeah, and it wasn't any kind of official sort of advisor role. It was more about Alexander Payne, the director, and his producer Jim Burke came, and we sort of just hit it off. And so he would say, if he were here tonight, that he was coming into my world. And so, of course, he's going to consult me. And I said, you also went into the world of Sideways, and you didn't let him on the set. And but I don't know. Maybe it's anyway. So my involvement was sort of showing him around the island, going out to dinner, having him come meet my friends, my family, going to parties together, and then he also involved me in casting, which is to ask, who I saw as Matt King, George Clooney. And then I got to watch all the audition tapes of sort of the minor roles, the minor characters. So he came over and, I turned on my laptop. He said, God, don't you clean this thing and put in the CD. And we or not CD because it's online, but we would watch these auditions and does this look right? Does that look right? And he was very open, not just to me, but to a lot of people, I think. And I was involved in the whole process pretty much. And he also let, you know, for the cousins, there's right. a big scene with the cousins at the table. And I said, let me call some friends. And so each of those cousins at that table, the board meeting, I had picked. And they all auditioned. They all had to go in. And everyone played themselves. Even the actors hired, when asked how to do it, when looking for direction from Alexander, his direction was, play yourself. Huh. Yeah.
One of the interesting things funny things about reading the novel is in the novel, when we first see Scotty walking down the hospital corridor, mm-hmm. her T-shirt says on Mrs. Clooney.
In the book.
In the book,
yes.
Yeah, in the book. And it's an interesting kind of reference to the
yes.
movie.
Yeah.
Before the movie was made.
I know.
You know, it seems it seems like a happy coincidence.
It's such a happy coincidence. And right now I'm writing a book and I'm going to have someone wear a T-shirt that says Mrs. Pitt, you know. Just to ensure this is a trend.
It's a great strategy.
Yeah. So, no, that was a very odd detail. Yeah.
I wonder if we could talk a little bit about, as we heard, mm-hmm. one of the most unmistakable, it should be said, the sentence is such a terrific, terrific and wonderful book. And congratulations on such an incredible novel. I mean,
thanks.
Really, it's a pleasure to read. It's,
thank you.
And certainly, like, what's distinctive about it as a novel is the unmistakable quality, timbre of the voice of Matt King. Mm. And I wonder if you would talk a little bit. It seems to me that point of view narration, that voice that permeates it, is at once very much a part of the film and yet also in some ways the hardest thing to capture mm-hmm. in a film. Can you talk a little bit about how does that sound to you, like that voiceover? That kind of
yeah. Well, the voice is hard to capture in film because unless you're doing, a voiceover
right.
The entire time. So Clooney had to sort of convey this sort of besieged, overwhelmed, somewhat sardonic, irritable mm-hmm. voice. He had to carry that with sort of his expressions, which I thought he did just really well. And, of course, Alexander's dialogue and the interaction he had with others. I think my Matt King was a little more sarcastic, mm-hmm. a little more dark. And Alexander made his Matt King, because it's sort of like Alexander, a little dorkier. And, and a little softer. His pants worn a little higher than my Matt King would wear his pants. My Matt King would drive a truck, and his Matt King drove a Honda Civic. But little variations all to make it personal to him. And I don't think it would be an intimate film if he was say, adapting Twilight or something where you want every detail to
yeah.
be just like the book so the fans don't go crazy.
Yeah.
So he had that liberty to go where he wanted to go, to make it personal and mm-hmm. intimate and to find his way in. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we feel that in the way that, as I was saying, like the real separateness of the movie in many ways.
Mm-hmm. So
it's very odd, this laptop here. We can't, you know.
I know.
it's a very awkward dinner party here with this laptop. Well, we have, as you know, we're very proud of you in the English department. It's great having you as an example to our students. I think people come in the geology department, mm-hmm. and they say, you know, what's your life goals? And they say, you know, to write a novel that's adapted into a film that wins the Golden Globe for Best Picture. And that's a long shot in geology. It's great the way that in English, your example allows me as somebody who teaches prose fiction here to say, yeah, it's totally, you know, come on.
Yeah,
for
totally
sure.
Possible.
Yeah, you gotta write, you know, if the book is good enough.
Yeah.
And so we've been, of course, as a department, you know, talking formally and informally about what we should ask you. A lot of my colleagues have, and even just today I was at outside Dan Tynan's office. Dan Tynan's here today, of course, a long, you know, distinguished faculty member. And he had a very specific question. I'll just, you know, if I might. Mm-hmm. Dan's question is, you know, what is George Clooney really like? You know, I just passed that along. It's not from me.
Oh my gosh, that is hilarious. Oh yeah. My god. Okay. So the first time, the first time I met him, yeah, was at dinner. And he kind of plopped down next to me. And had me and the entire table just in stitches. And it wasn't sort of like that nervous laughter where you have to laugh at someone because he's king. You were genuinely laughing. And then, by the end of the dinner, he, for some reason, poured his wine into his vodka glass and sucked it all through the straw and then got tapped on the shoulder and said, God, I gotta go. And so it's funny because this was the first introduction I had to George Clooney.
Right.
And I had known Alexander for a while before that. So we looked at each other across the table and we're like sort of widened our eyes as in, oh my God, what have we done? Who can this guy do this? You know, he was almost this fool, this clown. And we were very... At least I wasn't that nervous, but Alexander was nervous. He was just sort of, okay, we need to get to work, and hopefully this guy will show up. But then, you know, the meetings after that, he was the last guy to leave the party and the very first guy to show up at work. And you know, I didn't know this at the time, but after working each day, all day on the Descendants, and just being so... Such a hardworking guy. Right. He would go and write Ides of March in his room. But the next time I saw him was when I was acting in a scene, and I was part of a crowd like you all were, and he stood up here because it was the party scene where he's talking to the party and explaining to his friends that his wife wasn't going to make it, so he was standing up here and. You know, first it was the audition, and he looked at everyone, and it was a very somber scene, and he just said, you guys do know that I was two-time sexiest man alive, right? Two-time. And so we're like, oh, God, ha, ha, ha. You know, and this time we really were laughing because he's king. But anyway, so then Alexander says, okay, let's roll, we're rolling, and he does the monologue. And... He had every actor. These were extras. My mom was one of the extras. My husband, my three girlfriends. We were all crying. It was the most unbelievable performance.
Wow.
And we were just shocked. And then Alexander said, okay, let's do it. It wasn't even for real. That was just a warm-up. So then he broke into a joke and said, oh, relax, I'll just marry another one. And then... Scene, and then he was on again, so he could just turn it on, and he didn't have to have this big preparation, and he wasn't a diva about things. So he was genuinely just a wonderful guy who doesn't rest on just that. I mean, obviously, he just got arrested for in D.C. for his work protesting in Sudan, and yeah, he's just amazing.
Wow.
Yeah.
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 Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I think we're going to watch another clip here. This is a clip, the scene at Tahiti Nui, which is a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the clips that that you suggested. Can you tell us, you know, as they say, talk show business. You want to set this up a little bit? Tell us about how you were, you know, why you might, why you
yeah.
wanted to
say that. Yeah, well, I don't know exactly what part you're showing, but it's funny because I was just in Tahiti Nui over Christmas with my family, and everyone at that bar who you'll see just happened to be in the bar at the time of shooting, and they're usually always at the bar. And that waitress was the waitress, and I went in and said, oh, have you seen yourself in the movie? Oh, I haven't seen it yet. You know, everyone, again, plays themselves. But it's very great because they received a lot of business after this. And Everyone drives slowly by and then comes in to the restaurant. But, yeah, let's
All
roll
right, let's
it.
Take a look at it here.
It's cousin Hugh. Grab that table and order me something.
What do you want?
Anything. Hey, Hugh.
Hey, Matty boy. What you doing here? I didn't expect to see you till the meeting.
Yeah, no, I'm just getting the girls out of the hospital for a couple of days.
Oh, is that?
It's Scotty and Alex.
Oh, big girls now.
Yeah, I just need a little change of scenery.
Oh, yeah, boy, what you've been going through, that's a tough deal.
Yeah.
But Elizabeth, hey, tough gal, I'll tell you that. A fighter. She's gonna make it. Get you a drink?
Yeah, whatever you have.
Julia!
Hey.
Old fashioned from my cousin here.
All right.
Nice to see you, man.
You too.
How you been otherwise?
Not much otherwise. Between our business and the hospital, I'm just trying to keep my head above water.
Yeah.
Listen, I see that you have some people staying at the cottage.
Maddie, if I'd known you were coming, I could have moved those people out.
No, not that at all. It's just, I was wondering about the guy that you're running to. I think his name is Brian Spear.
Oh, yeah. Real determined son of a bitch. He's Lou's sister's. Lou has a sister, the sister's husband. Lou's brother-in-law's cousins with that guy.
I love that. We think about where to cut that scene. I love that, the way that it ends with, you know, the cousins. And the way, here you talk about the film and the way in which your family and friends are involved in it. The sentence is that, is it that kind of novel where people in Hawaii are reading it? And you were saying, you often say, like, people in Hawaii, everybody sort of knows everybody else. When you write about your home like that, people tend to see in your fiction all kinds of things, see themselves.
Yeah.
Have you had any particularly strange experiences like that?
Well, not so strange, but, you know, this situation with the land and the family is similar to, truth, to factual things. And I sort of looked at a bunch of families and their situations and blended it into my own creation. But my family is a missionary descent. We are missionary descendants, this branch of family I belong to. And, you know, cousin Hugh was sort of the leader of, and he was the one in charge. And I don't know why I picked cousin Hugh as the name, but of course I did. And I wasn't even thinking of it. And so I have gotten into a lot of, not trouble, but a lot of people thinking things are about them when I really wasn't even considering them. And I get a lot of emails like, the woman in the coma is based on Aunt Patsy, isn't it? And, you know, I say, well, no, she never had an affair with anyone. And they really try to piece things together because for some reason truth or the fact, I don't know, maybe they want it to be true.
Yeah.
Like, that has more import, or, but no, there's some things Like, for example, the Outrigger Canoe Club banned them from filming there because a part of my book said, Matt King says, it's elite, and it's an elitist club. But, you know, for me, that's the nature of a club. you know, it's going to be a little exclusive and elitist, and I'm a member of the Outrigger Canoe Club, so what does that say about me? But little things people took offense to, which I feel that then I've done my job.
Right.
As a fiction writer.
Told the truth.
Not to be offensive, but to have it ring true.
Can you talk a little bit about, there's a great article that you wrote for the Wall Street Journal in which you talk about the use of setting. And I was taken back by your closing comments, and you say, setting is something that should define and confine a character. It's not the puppet, it's the puppet master.
Mm-hmm.
And alongside that, you said you've talked about The Descendants. The Descendants, it's a book about Hawaii, but not really.
Mm-hmm.
And so can you talk a little bit about the challenges but also the advantages about writing about Hawaii? Like, what were you, you know, take us a little bit into that process.
Well, I think it helped that, or it helped me. I mean, I wrote this when I lived in San Francisco. And right now I'm writing a book that's set in Colorado, and I'm in Hawaii. But I think the distance, especially as a fiction writer, not as a nonfiction writer, of course, allows you to not be, to rely purely on truth.
Yeah.
First, you rely on memory and impressions and sort of the things that have stuck. And so I guess writing from a distance sort of helped. I'm trying to trace back to your question. What's that? Oh, about setting.
Yeah, about setting. Define and confine.
Yeah.
Love that.
Well, I just feel that, especially at least for Matt King's character, place and setting defined him, and it completely confined and dismantled him in a way, and almost directed the path he chose and the choices he made and the problems he was up against. I mean, completely,
mm-hmm.
literally. I don't think it's just about something I tried to do in Hawaii. I think it's something I do want to do with any place I write about. To have it not just be a backdrop,
mm-hmm.
but to actually intrude upon the story and the characters' lives.
What did you think of Matt King as a character, as somebody who's at once very much enmeshed in Hawaii, and at the same time he's got this very sort of almost cynical attitude, you know? So it's
change that, right? No, I'm just kidding. I don't care.
But you know, the kind of, he says things like, you know, it's sunny outside, it's beautiful. Who cares? It's so cynical. What did you think of the rendering of Hawaii? It's such a visually lush movie.
Mm-hmm.
And as you were talking about the music, you know, what was your take on that?
On their rendering of
Hawaii?
Yeah,
on their rendering of
I thought it, I mean, I couldn't have really done it better.
Yeah.
I felt it, especially, you know, when they, those first shots of Honolulu, the traffic in Chinatown, and the homeless woman, and that paired with beauty. I mean, it's both. They're both. I don't think it's a surprise. And you know, in a lot of the reviews, it's Hawaii really is paradise. And I think we all know that. I think it's just interesting to see something set there.
Yeah.
I don't think we've seen. I've never seen a film that's actually about people who live in Hawaii. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Something I couldn't do in the book was to just portray the beauty and stateliness of Kauai. And that I just felt was just captured beautifully.
So now you've teased us with this new book that you're working on, set in Colorado. And
I guess
you've you've brought it up. And I guess the question is how, you know, can you tell us a little bit about this new novel? In what degree does CC, you know, figure in it? And is there, in fact, a character based on George Butte, as he's been, you know? Because if there isn't, I would like to suggest one.
It's not something that's coming out anytime soon. It's not going to be published. It's just something I'm working on. But it's set in about a family who actually lives in Breckenridge, Colorado, and their past, they're a fourth generation there, and they have a bit of trouble, and they have to go to the Springs to visit for Parents' Weekend.
Oh.
To see the daughter who goes to Colorado College. And so they're at the Broadmoor for a night, and they come to CC, and that takes place near the end of the novel. So, yeah, I've got Breckenridge and the drive to Breckenridge. A lot of it takes place in the car on that drive.
And then perhaps a flash of Professor Butte walking across the...
I think there needs to be a cameo.
I'm just suggesting, put it in there, use it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Jane Hilberry river rafting.
So we're going to watch two last clips. And these clips are ones in which you appear. And and so we thought, you know, as a kind of actor's studio here, we would conclude with this with your. So do you think that acting is it now an avenue that you're going down, or?
Well, I can now say that I played opposite of George Clooney.
So now,
it's not a bad first gig.
It's an okay gig. Yeah,
yeah.
Anyone will say that.
Forget writing. What I really want to do is act.
So we're gonna watch two clips. We're gonna watch the one where the cousins are there, and then the party or the get together when he discloses the fact that Joni isn't going to be waking up.
Unlike a lot of my cousins, I haven't blown my share of the trust money. Just like my father before me, I live only on the income from my law practice. I don't want my daughters growing up spoiled and entitled. Liz always accuses me of stinginess, but I agree with my father. You give your children enough money to do something, but not enough to do nothing.
Matt, your cousins are here.
Not only am I the sole trustee, but I specialize in real estate transaction law. So a few of the more involved cousins have been meeting with me regularly to analyze the bids. Cousin Hal, Cousin Milo, Cousin Stan, Cousin Six, Cousin Wink, Cousin Connie, and Cousin Dave, both of whom oppose the sale entirely.
Good to see you.
Don't be fooled by appearances. In Hawaii, some of the most powerful people look like bums and stuntmen.
Hi, Mr. King.
Hello, Buzz.
Sorry about Mrs. King. Hope she gets better real soon.
Thanks.
It really blows.
I know. You've all asked questions about Elizabeth, and I've given vague answers. But I asked you all here today to tell you that her coma is permanent. She's not going to make it. So this week, tomorrow, in fact, as per her wishes, we are going to unhook her from life support. You all know Elizabeth. She has to do everything on her own. I wanted to tell you all in person, because you are all our dear friends. You're our best friends. The girls and I so much appreciate everything that you have done for us in the last few weeks. Bringing food and calling.
Can we go see her?
Yes. Yes, for God's sake. Yes, that's the whole point. Go see her as soon as possible. That's what I want to tell you. All of you. It should be now, not after.
So while that was running, you said you had another story. That's great.
Yeah. The cousins, and one of them, the only female cousin that was there, is my mom's best friend, or should I say frenemy, because they, you know, they fight all the time. Tiari, who was sort of the inspiration for my Joni character. Not that she had an affair or anything, but that she, you know, her, she rides Harleys. She rides, she does speedboats. Her mom was this famous race car driver. And all the medals that you see in the film were hers, all the trophies.
Oh,
and,
wow.
Yeah, and she used to be a model for Coppertone. And huh. Yeah, so she was sort of my inspiration. And yeah,
I love that, how it just, that I think that feel, we all feel that the movie is so authentic, and it's that you really use a lot of the artifacts that, you know, people who you know really well.
That's also her house with the goat.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you, and I want to just, I know that there, I've really enjoyed our conversation. Thank you, and it's been great.
Thank you guys so much. I really appreciate this.
Thank you.